Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fantide, the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations around the gray areas in our lives. I am light bright and watching Travel wake up as we're on Zoom. Jarrett Hill.
You're welcome. I am entertainment editor, journalist, what did I say? Entertainment journalist, editor, author, rest times to all of the above. Travel Anderson, Travel Anderson, if you're nasty. And coming up on the show today, we have a special guest, if you have not seen based on the title. And we're going to be talking about, you know, anti-blackness within Latinx communities, about the role of the quote-unquote brown man in race discussions. Really interesting conversation, so stay tuned for that. But first, we have a Pass the Popcorn here. Jarrett wanted to talk about Elon Musk and the Twitter debacle that is happening, so take it away.
Well, you may have heard that Elon Musk is becoming the grand buzzard of the Twutwux clan.
Already is. It's official.
It's raising infinite questions about what happens when something that's become essentially a public utility falls into the hands of a, quote, sole director. As you may know, Twitter has been bought by one of the real-life Marvel supervillains, keeping Big Pharma alive with anxiety medications.
Oh, wow.
There are many questions and reports on this one. Let's hit a few of them hot topic style. So, Travel, I know that you are an anchor person nowadays and covering a lot more news.
Sure.
Elon Musk has fired the board and become sole director of Twitter. Is that right?
Well, I don't know if the board was paid, but he has disbanded the board. He is now he's the CEO and the only board member. He is running all of the things himself. There are still senior leadership members, like people in senior leadership, but the top people reportedly were escorted out of the building last week on Friday. And so, you know, he's the big honcho right now. The reports say that, you know, anti-black racist behavior, use of the N-word and whatnot went up 500% after it was announced that he was, you know, the new boss. We all know that he's one of those people who pervert the definition of free speech in favor of bigotry.
I will say that the thing that concerns me about this is actually what really concerned me about Trump in 2015 and 16 is like the idea of the people that come with him. You're escorting all these people out of the building, but you also have to fill a lot of those roles, the ones that you do fill, because we also watch Trump like empty out the government and then not fill in a lot of those places. But the things that are always concerning to me is like the people that come in are going to be people that have like the ideology of an Elon Musk or a Donald Trump. And there actually may not be a whole lot of distinction between those two things on a lot of issues. And so I get worried about like what that means for Twitter as it goes forward and like how we're going to see Twitter change. That's scary to me. One of the things I also saw is that verification might become a cost. I know that Twitter's had a hard time being profitable over the years, so actually this makes sense, but I also think it's some bullshit because anyone that wants to pay for it is seemingly going to be able to be verified. I know we haven't really gotten like the details on how they're going to go about that process, but like, would you pay $20 a month to be verified on Twitter? Because we're already verified as it is.
I would write that hoe off. If I did end up paying, right, I would write it off. But verification should not be something that someone has to pay for, because what it will do, right, it will flip the intention of the verification, right? Verification was started as a way to, one, confirm that a particular account is handled and managed by a specific particular person, right? And not, you know, someone posing as another individual. And then also it was a way to like be like, oh, this person is verified. Theoretically, they are of some sort of import, right? And import in this case can mean a variety of things. You can get verified, or back in the day, you could get verified. Like, I got verified because I worked at the LA Times, right? That's how I got my checks, my Twitter check to be specific, versus, you know, they also verify influencers up to a certain level. You know, it's all this, you know, jiggering that happens behind the scenes. But a lot of people are like, they won't pay for the verification. And they're like, listen, if it's going to turn to shit, I'm just going to leave anyway. And I think the thing important thing for me to note with that is that, like, you know, not everybody's going to be able to leave. It's going to be a little complex and mixy as to, like, who leaves, why they leave, where we go from there, etc.
I'm actually intrigued by this because Twitter has always been a business, right? And they've had a hard time making profit. But I should say that Twitter's goal with verification was never profit, right? It was credibility. And so now the idea of verification, the purpose of verification being profit, is going to mean that who gets verified and what verification means is going to potentially be different depending on what those terms end up looking like. In the same way that if we privatize Social Security or the mailbox, the post office and other places, like when you make something about profit that was not about profit before, the goal will be to verify more people so you can charge more people.
This isn't a confirmed policy yet, right? But if it does happen, I can see plenty of people who are currently verified not paying for verification, and I can see the verification just becoming a symbol of foolishness. You verify, oh girl, you foolish for spending $20 a month or whatever, right? Like I'm interested to see how it would like manifest and just ultimately change how we view individual accounts, not based on verification or not, which is how it has been, you know, in a lot of ways thus far. Maybe we will come up with another way to say, like, oh, this is an account that you should follow. This is somebody who is saying interesting stuff that's not rooted in the actual check itself. I also note that, you know, there are also reports that Elon is considering bringing Vine back in some capacity. Now, I like this idea. I like this idea, okay? Because Vine was a very special moment in culture. Right. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure it would still be, you know, or it would become a cesspool of, you know, anti-black, transphobic, homophobic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But all of these apps have that, like Libs of TikTok, for example. Right. Like all of that is still here. I just remember so much joy that many of us got from the Vine days.
I'm intrigued by that one. I will say the other thing that might be coming back quickly is Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's not on Twitter in terms of, like, we're not getting his, like, stream of consciousness, right? But, you know, when Trump wanna say something, we all still know what Trump has said, even though he's not himself on Twitter.
That's fair.
And so some might say he's never even really left. And we should say that, you know, there are plenty of, you know, progressive-minded black folks, other folks of communities who work at Twitter who've been trying to make it a better, safer place for everybody. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this affects their jobs, how this affects, you know, the efforts that they've been undertaking to make Twitter better. We'll see, Chad. We'll see. We're going to take a quick break, okay? And when we come back, we're going to get into our conversation with Chris Rivas. Stay tuned. We know that you have heard about microdosing. Why? Because you listen to the show, okay? And if you don't listen to the show regularly and this is your first time, well, guess what? We about to bring you up to speed, okay? Just know that all sorts of people are microdosing THC daily to feel healthier and perform better. I've told y'all about its particular uses, particularly with LumiLab specifically, okay, for our creative processes, when we're writing these books, when we're putting these podcasts together, when we are trying to change the world, one thought at a time, okay? Actually, the thing that I want to focus on, because we don't talk about this enough, and it's the flavor, okay, of the gummies. Okay, they're so delectable, okay? Mm-hmm. Trust me. Our show today, in case you can't tell, is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. You need to check them out. Okay, we don't want you to take our word for it, okay? We want you to try it out for yourself. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use code FANTI to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description. But again, that's microdose.com, code FANTI.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. No matter what I do, mopping, sweeping, like, it's just the floors are never clean enough. So I bought this steamer because I was like, maybe that will help, right? I opened up the box and there are just like pieces everywhere. And I'm the kind of person who's pretty handy and knows how to use things and blah, 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 blah. But like, there were so many pieces in there. I was like, I'm so grateful there's a user's manual in here because I need to figure out how to use all of this. But life don't be coming with a user manual. So when it's not working for you, it's normal to kind of feel stuck sometimes. And like, life not coming with a user's manual oftentimes will require you to ask yourself a lot of questions and try to figure out what the answers are. But having a therapist can really be one of the best ways to help you ask great questions and get great answers. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with the therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/fanti. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/fanti.
Welcome back, beautiful people. So if you've been on Twitter as long as I've been on Twitter, you've experienced various iterations of the convo we're going to have today about the relationship between the Blacks and the Latinxes, as I like to say. Maybe you remember the discourse around the movie In the Heights from last year, in which folks were wondering, where are the Afro-Latinx folks in Washington Heights? Why are they all in the background? Or perhaps you were there when a little show called Love and Hip Hop Miami introduced many to the story of Amara La Negra and her unique experiences navigating life as a darker-skinned Black Latinx woman. Well, there's another iteration of this conversation happening right now, and it grows out of a news story here in LA. The TLDR of it: former City Council President Nuri Martinez and Councilmen Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon were caught saying some, you know, racist, anti-Black, otherwise problematic stuff on a secret recording of a convo between them from last year. It got leaked. All three of these council people are Latino Democrats. In addition to some of the horrible things they said about a Black child, they were basically scheming to protect their political clout in the redrawing of council districts at the expense of, among other groups, Black folks here in LA. People were protesting. There were some apologies. Some censoring happened. Stepping down happened. All of the stuff. But there was and is talk yet again about the relationships between Black folks and Latinx communities in particular. And so, joining us today to get into the complex and complicado of it all, we have Christopher Rivas, actor and author of the new book that you all should get, Brown Enough, True Stories About Love, Violence, The Student Loan Crisis, Hollywood, Race, Familia, and Making It in America. Chris, welcome to FANTI.
Thank you very much. Longest book title ever.
You know what? If it works for you, it works for
you. You hit it
me.
On one breath. That's impressive.
So, Chris, fix racism for us.
Okay.
We've got time. We've got a whole show here. I want to actually look at a bit of the synopsis that you all provided about the book, because I think it actually poses exactly the question that I was hoping to ask you, and I thought it did a really great job. It says, Brown Enough opens with a moment that forever changed Christopher Rivas's life, the night Ta-Nehisi Coates shared in an intimate gathering in downtown L.A., the brown man's role in the race conversation. Quote, all I hear is Black and white. As a brown man, a Latin man, where does that leave me? Coates took a short breath and responded, not in it. And it goes on to explain more. And this was interesting to me because you describe this moment as feeling like a reprimanded child. And like that kind of like stung. And I was like, I imagine that did not feel great. That it seemed like it was a painful thing. And it has always made me think about how there's a bit of hierarchy in the conversations that we have around race. And I wonder what it feels like, how you think about it, how folks that are not black or white or don't fit cleanly into those you know, titles, how they think about the conversation about race when it doesn't tend to center them. And I think that this book aims to get at that. And I've just started it, so I can't say that I've read the whole thing, but I am intrigued by your perspective on how you think about that sort of hierarchy when we're thinking about race.
I'm going to go to your first prompt, which was like, fix racism.
You got an answer?
I got an answer. The answer is not mine alone. It is James Baldwin, and he said something along, you know, not verbatim. As soon as we put one person in the cage, we put everybody in the cage. Mm-hmm. And nobody's free mm-hmm. until everybody's free. White people included. Mm-hmm. They too are in cages. Easy sentence to say. Wild work to embody. Mm-hmm. To take on, to speak out about, to be vocal about, to move through the world in that way with the goal of freedom. That said, everyone who is a body of culture is under the gaze of whiteness. Mm-hmm. Everyone. There is whiteness and then there's everything else. And the world has done a really good job for a long, 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 long time. All our ancestors have had to suffer this, and it's global. It's not just American, right? It's an image. It's in colorism. It's what you said about the council people in L.A., right? Like, Latinos got a whole ton of, you know, colonialism and anti-blackness work they got to look at and work through and be honest about. Honesty, that's a good place to start to fix racism. Absolutely. Honesty. And yeah, so I had that moment with Coates, and it stung, but it also brought me gratitude. Like, it was all the feelings. I think any moment that shatters you, like, being shattered is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It means you put yourself in a space to be moved and to learn something and to grow. And I think Coates called it like he saw it and called it like it is. Mm. We live in a binary world. You are he, she. You are this, that. You are right, wrong. You are pass, fail. We don't know how to hold middle spaces. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is one way we can start to be more honest and more inclusive, is to embrace that middle space.
Embrace the middle space. You know, I like that as the non-binary one on the team. I like that and I appreciate that. Just kind of following up on your question, Jared, about, like, one, the role of the brown man in all of this, as your question to Coates, but also in terms of just the discussions, various discussions that you have in the book, and for me, that comes down to, like, what does this all look like in very real terms, right? What does being part of the conversation, being part of the solution, look like in real terms? Is it, you know, we often talk about on this show about the responsibility that we all have to, like, you know, call up Meemaw and say, Meemaw, you own some foolishness. Like, was, you know, we need to work through this thing or whatever. From your vantage point, Chris, what does being part of that conversation, being part of the solution, like, look like in real terms?
I think that's right. I mean, yeah, start with Meemaw, start with family. But it's also, and now I got to say, right, like, we also need to survive, right? We also have to. And so if you're in a workspace and you're faced with a moment of, should I voice? Should I use my voice right now? Should I call this out? And you're willing that might take away your check. That might harm something. That might, you know, make it more difficult to put food on the table. And you aren't ready to make that choice. That too is okay. But as long as you're conscious that you wanted to make the choice, but you didn't, and this is why. I always say ignorance is bliss until you've tasted bliss, then the rest is just ignorance. And when you start to...
Wait, say that again?
Ignorance is bliss until you've tasted bliss, and then the rest is just ignorance.
Okay, 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 okay.
And I think when moving through the world as a body of culture who's saying, like, you know what? I'm going to actually take action. I'm going to use my voice. It means you tasted bliss. You tasted the bliss of unplugging from whiteness, of not caring what other people think, of not trying to make them happy, receive checks from them. But you were like, nah, I want to sign checks. I don't want to keep pleasing you. I need to please myself. I need to love myself. So yeah, we have to take action. That's the overall point we must get to as everybody, right? Everybody's in the cage. Everybody has to start using their voice and taking action.
I want to come back to this hierarchy question, because it's something that when I read like this kind of like the thesis, or like kind of the starting point of your book, I was curious about how prior to this moment with Coates, and you talk about this in your new book, Brown Enough, which is available now wherever books are sold. Because I'm concerned about the way that this hierarchy of sorts stands to divide us in a moment when things are very volatile as it is, and getting worse and worse by the day. And I think to myself, like, if we don't figure out like how to all be unified on one side, we stand to be divided when, you know, the seeming race war comes. So I'm more so thinking about, but I also think about this from like a unity perspective, for progress, right? Like, we're always a lot more strong and valuable and effective when we're all working together. But like, I don't know that without like addressing this piece that is always kind of looming, of like how blackness gets attention in race conversation, but being brown in the various ways that we define that doesn't. And like, is that frustrating? Is that painful? Is it confused? Like, how does it feel as a brown person to hear that black and white conversation, and not feel included, but feel, I guess, part of the conversation about race, but not, I don't know if I'm framing that well, but it's just been something in my mind for a while.
Yeah. You know, I don't feel frustrated because I didn't know it was a thing until that moment with Coates. Like, and then it was a journey of discovering that space, discovering what it means to take up space as a brown person. How do I use my voice? How do I use my body? How do I step up against injustice? What does it mean that, like, I can play both sides? I can hang out, you know, with a little bit of everybody. How have I been navigating? How have I been pretending, assimilating? Like, so much was uncovered in that moment. So there isn't a frustration. And I think part of it comes down to, many brown people in this world don't know that they're not in it, because the need to survive is so subconscious. And when I say survive, it really means the need to be closer to whiteness. You know, the want to move up a ladder, any ladder, and that ladder is often held by white bodies, by white minds, by white consciousness, white ideas. Unless you can fall right into the power of blackness. Like, unless you clearly are a brown person, you know, Afro-Latinidad, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-any, and you can fall into blackness and then you found your community there. Right? But again, we are tribal people. Like, we are tribal people. And because brownness never really clearly, what is it, Howard Gardner, Brief History of America, he said the greatest trick America ever pulled was convincing people that it was better to be poor and white than poor and black. Right? So then he says that we instantly added capitalism and money to race. So it wasn't just race. Now we're adding your finances, your career, your movement, your social mobility. So I think brown people all over the world, right? When you go to Mexico, when you go to Colombia, when you go to the DR, there ain't an ad with a black person in it. You know, and most of those countries have those people. But no, all the ads are like the light-skinned ones.
So that actually kind of brings me perfectly to the thing that I was jotting down as you were speaking. Like, we've had conversations here about colorism before, and how colorism shows up, and the way that interacts with that anti-blackness, and even our own color prejudices that we see from black folks with lighter skin, from darker skin black folks to lighter skin black folks, but being distinct that it is not quite colorism, right? Because of the way that isms work. I'm curious, you are a lighter skinned Latin man, and I'm curious how you experience colorism and how you discuss it with, you know, the people in your community. In your community, not like Latinx community, but like the community of friends and colleagues and people that you interact with every day.
Yeah, you know, part of the awakening for me was like, why does my black grandmother not think she's black, you know, and always said, no, they're black. I'm me. I'm Dominican. And it's like, nah, you black. Mm-hmm. Like, why did my parents make jokes about me being adopted? Because I had like the curliest, thickest hair and the biggest lips and the biggest nose. There's that family joke, you know, like we're called big nose by the ones we love. Where does that come from? What's the history of that? As a Dominican man, in my blood, there's one of the worst genocides of all time against Haitians. You know, people from the same land, the same island, similar features. As a matter of fact, it's like, you know, it was called the Perejil massacre, right? Parsley massacre, because you actually couldn't tell the Dominicans from the Haitians by look alone. So you asked them to pronounce Perejil, and if they rolled their R's, it was from one part of the island versus the French side, they would say it differently. And I was speaking with a Haitian woman on the Ruby Rosa podcast, and she said, my mother used to teach me to roll my R's in fear that in case something else ever happened, I should know how to roll my R's. How do I deal with it in my community? I think I take ownership. Like, I am the first to boast about my privilege of being able to play both sides. I also work in Hollywood, which is a weird, scary lie. Like, that tries to sell you the image. Tries to sell you the image of the world, but it's not the actual image of the world. You know, my neighborhood, Queens, was the image of the world, in my opinion. Like, it's the most diverse place, I think, in the world, scientifically, especially Jackson Heights. And so the only way I could take ownership within my community, you know, whether it's Latinidad or my friends or family, is ask these questions. I believe in questions more than answers. Like, we are always looking for answers, but we don't ask fat enough questions. And on the opposite side of a really scary question, you might be able to live yourself into an answer. And so I think as a light-skinned, you know, brown man, I have to ask big questions about my own privilege and how I've been moving closer towards whiteness or, you know, further away from blackness and what that means.
I had a friend who recently shared with me that they were watching a TikTok video, and then Travelle, I'll come back to you, but they said to me that the woman in the video was talking about psychology, and like the first thing she said was, you know how all of psychology is based on how much you think like a white man? And like had like and didn't remember anything else after the TikTok video, because everything went to Charlie Brown, like wah 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 after that, like whoa, right? And like I've spent a lot of time over the years, and have had like in drafts for years, like this idea around trying to unpack the many ways that white supremacy shows up that we're not like thinking about it. And like colorism is one of those that feels obvious, right? But then you kind of started talking about like the nose and the hair and the way that they speak about different features and that kind of thing. And it's like, it shows up in the subtle ways that aren't as overt as talking about skin tone. But Travelle, I'll let you go back.
I'd be tired to talk about race. I don't know about y'all. Okay. I feel like I'm always, you know, fighting Jesus, you know, something. If it's not race, it's transphobia and homophobia. If it's not that, it's anti-blackness within the black community. You know, it's just always something. And so for me, you know, I just, you know, there are some times where, I'll say it this way. I can understand a person being like, you know what? Those issues, that conversation, that ain't for me. I'm over here trying to, you know, make sure the lights don't turn off. I don't have the wherewithal, sort of what you were saying, Chris, earlier. I don't have the wherewithal or the ability in this moment to push back, right, in the office. Or, you know, I'm really just trying to eat my fried chicken and collard greens. I don't have the energy to be telling Meemaw that, you know, she is perpetuating whatever ism and obia or whatever. And I just wonder, like, do y'all get tired of talking about race too? Or is there something else baked into even the exhaustion that, right, needs to be teased out? I don't know if I'm making any sense here.
I mean, I'm with you in the exhaustion, like, but I think we're not alone in that. I think we are the generation that will be exhausted, because in order in order for an illusion to be destroyed, it takes work, right? Like, and this is the state of the world we have inherited. Waking up, and waking up ain't easy. We've all seen The Matrix. Like, it takes work. You got to rip those things out. You got to, like, get in this pot. Like, it's work, and it's nasty work. But there's a chance that there is beautiful freedom on the other side. Like Nina Simone says, right? What is freedom? No fear.
I will often have conversation with friends about, like, looking at the state of the world, and sometimes you're like, shit is bleak. We got dealt quite a hand. But then we also think sometimes, I've been studying leadership over the last couple of years a lot more, and I believe it was in Barack Obama's book, talking about how you have to be optimistic to be in leadership, because you keep, what are you working for if you're not going to be optimistic? And I think that as a people, I think we also have to be optimistic, not even just as leaders. But I think about how it is sometimes hard to be optimistic, even in the midst of, like, when you're doing great work, when you're seeing other people who are doing really good work or having conversations, it is hard to be optimistic. I imagine that there is a part of you that finds even like a kernel of hope sometimes, in all of these conversations that we're having. And I'm curious what that has looked like for you, what hope is looking like for you over the course of, like, this book, even just like promoting the book as it's coming out and doing the work that you do every day, or in your podcast regularly. How are you thinking about, like, being hopeful and what's coming and as we're looking at the future?
I have tremendous hope and no hope all at the same time. And I think that's okay. And I think that's okay. And I think it's, you know, the Buddhist in me loves the word equanimity. Equanimity is the ability to stay stable amongst duress. So imagine, like, you are a skinny little pole and the wave knocks you left and right and the wave is winning. And then eventually you get a little sturdier, a little thicker, a little more rooted in the earth, a little more tall, reaching towards heaven. And the waves, they don't knock you as much, right? They just don't knock you as much. And then eventually you're so large, you're the waves themselves. You're the earth itself. Like, you ain't going nowhere. You can hold all this stuff inside you. So you can hold suffering and joy all at the same time. You can hold hope and no hope all at the same time. You can hold love and pain all at the same time. And you know it's all a part of this thing we call life, this journey. And all of this is a part of that. Look at the conversation we're having now. And I know one person listening to this is going to say some shit. Like, they're going to be like, I'm taking it back. I'm taking back my power. I'm taking up space. And that one person is contagious, and that hits another one. Mm-hmm. And then I do these book talks and these signings, and people weep, right? And weeping is good, right? Like Gabron says, I cried enough tears until I dug myself a permanent smile. They're breaking. They're seeing themselves. They're being opened. They're releasing. You know, that's hope that lives in the same place, you know, where I watch what politicians do and I'm disgusted and I lose hope. But it's like, no, it's still here. It's happening. There's a lot of good taking place. And our job, you know, as people with microphones, but for whatever that means, our job as people who know how to take up space or take classes on leadership because they are leaders, right, is to continue to lead and take up space and show people that they're seen and that they too get to unplug from whiteness. And they too get to take a nap when they're tired. Rest, bro. Chill. Because it ain't a race. Amen. It ain't a race. The whiteness wants you to think it's a race. You ain't got a race. Go home. Play the piano. Mm-hmm. Read a book. You know? Watch Game of Thrones. Chill.
You mentioned that we should be... that everyone should be more concerned about, like, the questions that we're asking as opposed to, you know, the specific answers. I'm wondering, what are some of those questions that you've been asking yourself that you feel like we as I think you've said body of culture a couple times.
Yes, the term I like.
So one, explain that, because I was going to ask that too. I was just going to let it, you know, pass, but I have now brought it up. So explain that for me, because I'm into it. And then also, what are some of the questions that you think we should be like asking ourselves as we're like doing this work?
Yeah, so body of culture, the first time I heard it was Resmaa Menakem. So I don't know if Resmaa created it, or I'll just, that's where I heard it, in an episode of On Being. Mm-hmm. And I love that term because we are more than our color, right? Like, they're not trying to, whiteness doesn't try and take your color. It tries to take your culture. Assimilation says, like, I want to make money off your culture, but I want you not to have it, right? I want to take your pool of genius and I want to turn it into a McDonald's. Like, you know, I want to take your pool of genius and turn it into a Taco Bell. I want to take your pool of genius and turn it into Lululemon yoga and yoga studios. Like, I want to take your cultural genius and make it mine. And that is what I love. I also think bodies of culture is a way that brings us, ideally, closer together, where it's like, no, we're all under the gaze of whiteness. We're all in it. We're all in it together. So that is why I use bodies of culture. Your other question is, what questions am I asking? You know, that whole book is questions. Like, each chapter is a question, and maybe the chapter is an answer. It often is. You know, why did I invest in the American dream? Why did my parents believe in it? Why did I take these student loans? Why did I date so many white women? Do white women find me attractive, or am I some exotic thing they think they should find attractive? Do I find white women attractive, or are they some savior because every movie told me they would save me, you know? Why do I think the hand I hold determines my worth more than my own hand? What do I want to leave behind in order to be a good ancestor?
First of all, let me not have you just run past some of these, because, like...
I'm about to say, baby, these are some heavy questions, honey. My God. Oh, Lord.
Yes, carry on. Sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
But yeah, questions. We have to ask big, fat questions of ourselves. You know, a persistent problem is a proper question not yet asked. And we have a lot of persistent problems in this world and in our own lives. And we need to ask the proper question. And, you know, unfortunately, asking the question might not look so... What you see on the other end of that might not look so good. I think that's one of the reasons we don't ask questions. It's because we ain't ready. So I ask a lot of questions about how I move through the world, why I move through the world, why I do the things I know are wrong for me, but I do them anyway. Like, it has been the source of my creativity and also my getting free all at the same time. And I happen to do it in a public way, which is not great for other people involved sometimes.
Listen. Okay. Chris, I'm really grateful for your brand new book called Brown Enough. Tell people how they can engage with more of the work that you do, and where they can find out more about you.
Yeah, cop the book everywhere books are sold. And Instagram is great. Christopher_Rivas. I'm also on Twitter and kind of all the spaces. But my website has pretty much everything, ChristopherRivas.com. I have two podcasts, Ruby Rosa, which is about the Dominican man James Bond was based on. And I have Brown Enough. We turn the book into a podcast, which is like a weekly show where we put incredible brown people on blast.
We love that. All right. The new book is called Brown Enough, True Stories About Love, Violence, the Student Loan Crisis, Hollywood, Race, Familia, and Making It in America. I almost did it in one breath, and then I grabbed another one there at the end, so I really kind of killed that for myself. Chris, thank you so much for being here. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to know what y'all think. Hit us up on the social media and let us know using the hashtag FantiFam. You can hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at FantiPodcast. When we come back, listener feedback, why y'all hate us so much, and dishonorable mentions. All that's coming up next. Don't go anywhere.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller.
Wow, Emily, we've been doing this podcast for 10 years.
I know, but hey, don't worry. You can jump in at literally any episode and hear us talk about some of our favorite stuff. Caterpillars becoming butterflies.
Martha Stewart flying around in a private jet full of trees. Yes, you heard me right, trees.
Neighbors becoming enemies. Just kidding.
Whatever messed up stuff we can find on Wikipedia.
Our impeccable taste in everything from dogs to TV shows to bodily functions.
And horses. Lots and lots of horses. Come for our horned up rants about the world. Stay for the catchy theme songs.
You might not learn anything, but we're a good hang.
Baby Geniuses. Every other week on MaximumFun.org. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart.
And I'm Jordan Morris, boy detective.
Our comedy podcast, Jordan Jesse Go, just celebrated its 15th anniversary.
It was a couple months ago, but we forgot.
Yeah, completely. Our silly show is 15 years old. That makes it old enough to get its learner's permit.
And almost old enough to get the talk.
Wow, I hope you got the talk before then. A lot of things have changed in 15 years. Our show's not one of them.
We're never changing, and you can't make us.
Jordan, Jesse, Go, the same forever at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alrighty, beautiful people, welcome back. It's time to get into our listener feedback segment. We've got a couple emails here this week. First and foremost, we have an email here from Stephanie with the title, the subject line, "What I Want to Be When I Grow Up." Hey, Travell and Jared, I just want to send some love to my parents for a second. There is a famous family anecdote that when I was about 3, a family friend asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. After a moment's contemplation, I replied, "Steffi, grow up, be woman, make soup." The joke for a long time has been that I didn't respond with a career and that my response was, on surface, very domestic and gendered, but now, as a grown-up who is a woman and makes great soup, I'm delighted. I'm 33 and I've had 3 to 4 distinct careers, but I never defined myself by them, and I'm grateful my parents clearly never pushed that narrative on toddler me. Thanks for the discussion and the fuzzy feelings it prompted. All the best, Stephanie. This was in response to the tweet that you had sent out that you mentioned on the show about asking kids what they want to be. What they want to be and not who they want to be or something like that.
There was a tweet that I was quote tweeting that someone was saying, like, you know, it's weird how we spend so much time. She said, "Baby, life has so much more to offer you than your career. I hope you realize that soon." And I tweeted, "Why do we grow up thinking and asking kids what they want to do for a living rather than who they want to be? I just realized how weirdly capitalist that is. All I want to grow up to be is free." One, I love this. Two, because it's soup season. But number one, just because it's really cute.
Soup season?
It is. It's like cold weather season. It's like time for casseroles and fall food. It's November, babe. Like, come on.
You don't do soups in the summer?
You can do soup whenever you want to do, but like it's soup season now. Like, it's fall food season.
And soup is a fall food? I'm asking for clarity. I'm not asking to be judgmental. I'm just asking for clarity.
I can see the concern in your face. Like, was I wrong for having soup in June?
You know, it's like when they say you're not supposed to wear white after Labor Day. And I'm like, well, girl, why not?
I don't give a fuck about that. Like, I be wearing white. And I'm like, do I look like the type of bitch that gives a fuck about that rule from the South? Like, girl, please. Anyway, we were talking about this letter from Stephanie. And I appreciated just kind of this piece also about having never defined yourself by your careers or the work that you've done. I've always been a person who identified as being tagless. And like, I know that some people really identify with their careers, and it's crazy because I really identify with my work, but I've never wanted to be known as like the journalist or the writer or the this, the that. I always wanted to be what I call tagless. And so like, it resonates with me that you never wanted to define yourself by your work. No tea, no shade to all the people who do really identify with their work and really connect with it in that way. That's just not how I'm set up. So shout out to you, Stephanie. Thank you for your email.
I am set up that way. I am a journalist. You gonna call me such, motherfucker.
Oh, see?
I'm just kidding.
Wow. They couldn't see the knife that you had that you were stabbing at the camera with, but we'll just let that rock.
Okay, we got another email here from Kristen with the subject line, this might be to me, "Don't do me. I love pumpkin spice and love this season, LOL.
I feel like this one's certainly to you. I don't know what is in question.
Kristen says, "As a black person, I feel attacked and shamed for my love for the pumpkin season. I appreciate it as akin to sweet potato pie and pumpkin pie flavored protein shakes with cream cheese and vanilla curves my sweet tooth. Add some Cool Whip or whipped cream with cinnamon too. Love y'all the same." saying thank you for the amazing content. You know what? I'm glad to see that the black folks who love pumpkin spice season are coming out of the closet about your identities. I love this for y'all. Would you just say, Jerry, you said you want to grow up to be free. And I am now happy that y'all are free from the confines of hiding your love of pumpkin spice. However, comma.
Oh, God.
Don't bring it to my house.
You ever seen a video of someone who was being held hostage and they're saying something that they feel like that they're being told that they have to say? And the way that they say the things, I am very happy for you black people who are coming out of the closet about liking pumpkin spice. You should be free. That's how that felt. To me, it felt like some bullshit.
Understood.
I'm gonna let that rock.
Understood how it felt.
But that's about my shit.
Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is.
Shout out to Kristen. I hope you like tater tots as well. I will Absolutely. Say that anything with cream cheese, anything with cream cheese, I'm leaning in a little bit to get more information. So I'm with you there. It is now time for our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week. They deserve a call out either for their good or for their stupid. I got a lot of shit to say, so I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, you got 12. No, you got 12 of them. Go on. Jump on into it. All right,
so I want to get into this clip from Jamal. Even a fuck nigga pastor can have a word to Bryant. You might know Jamal Bryant as the... Were they married on Potomac or were they... I know they have kids together, but I don't know that they were their ex... husband and wife, but they're exes.
I don't know that man. Well, I don't watch that show, I should say. I'm familiar with him outside of that show.
Okay, so I will just say that he is the ex of one of the women on Potomac. Mm-hmm. Why can't I think of her name? Ugh.
I don't know, because you hate black women.
Wow. Okay. Okay, so that's what we're doing. Got it. Okay.
You got the man's name right.
Not doing this with you. So Jamal is pastor of the New Birth Church in Lithonia, Georgia, which is right outside of Atlanta. And you may know that Herschel Walker is running against Reverend Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock, as he was called in the last election, which was always entertaining to me. But like Raphael Warnock has not really gone after Herschel Walker and the abortions and all of the things. However... another pastor in Atlanta did have something to say. Take a listen.
Y'all ain't ready for me today. Since Herschel Walker was 16 years old, white men been telling him what to do, telling him what school to go to, where to live, where to eat, where to buy a house, where to run, where to sit down, where to sleep, where to pay for abortions, where to buy a gun. And that you think they not gonna tell him how to vote? In 2022, we don't need a walker. We need a runner. We need somebody who gonna run and tell the truth about January 6th. We need somebody who gonna run and push for the cancellation of student loan debts. We need somebody who gonna run and make the former president respond to a subpoena. We don't need a walker. We need somebody who will be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding, knowing that your labor is not in vain. Georgia, I need you to know the slave Negroes y'all are used to don't live here no more. We can think for ourselves, function for ourselves, and vote for ourselves. Why? Because we don't need a walker.
Why? Because we don't need a walker. I will say that, like, the Herschel Walker case, like Jamal Bryant removed from it. I believe we've talked about this here before as well, but like it has bothered me to watch the way that we have seen Republicans just like completely ignore all the facts about Herschel Walker and really just lean into him because they want to win the Senate. I know you feel a way about Jamal. Go ahead. What you want to say?
A broken clock is right twice a day. And you know, now with that line he said, what he said.
We don't need a walker. We need a runner.
Yes, we don't need a walker. We need a runner. Now, baby, that'll preach, okay? I need Raphael Warnock to adopt that phrase in this last week until the election. I need him to be everywhere. We don't need a walker. We need a runner, okay? Play that on a loop.
We need someone ripping and running, but not someone running and ripping. If you know, what okay. I'm saying. Okay. Okay. Up next, I want to give an honorable mention to Ashanti Blaze Hopkins. Ashanti is now the first Black woman to serve as the vice president of the Society of Professional Journalists. Ashanti was just elected to that role over the weekend, and I reach out to her often, like, am I doing this right? Should I be doing this? And she's always been really fantastic, so I'm really grateful for SPJ to be able to have such a fantastic leader, so shout out to her. I want to give a shout out, an honorable mention to Carlton Clay. Carlton is a creator, writer, producer, and I've known him since my days at Clark Atlanta when he was creating shows. I'm on a show that he produced called College Days. I think I'm on like an episode or two or something back in the day. And he has been creating ever since. And he has a brand new film that's actually going to be out on Roku. It's called For the Love of Christmas. It is exclusively available on the Roku channel, starring, you know, some fantastic actors. The platform is going to have it exclusively starting as of Tuesday. So you can go check it out right now, For the Love of Christmas. And then on December 1st, it'll be available on various other platforms as well. And I just want to say I'm really, really proud of Carlton. He has continued to write. He has created many series, films. He's done so much really, really great work. And I'm excited for the continuation of his growth. I want to say to Actively Black, they are an Instagram account that I follow, and they do like activewear that is like themed for Black folks. They also have just now announced this really dope partnership that they're doing with Marvel and Disney for Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. They're doing wearable merch ahead of the film's release. And so you can go over to @activelyblack on Instagram to find out more about all of the Wakanda Forever gear that they've designed, and it's going to come out and you can buy it. You can sign up for the release of information because it's coming up soon, but it's all really, really dope. And I'm like, I want to get some of this because I love the stuff that they do. And obviously I'm a big Black Panther fan. I want to also just note, like, I don't know all the details on this story, and it's only hours old, but I saw a headline today that Takeoff was shot and killed. Takeoff, one of the members of Migos. Like, I know that there are controversial stories about each of these artists that are a part of Migos all the time, and I'm not going to pretend like I know all of them, but to see that Takeoff was shot and killed, I just wanted to, like, pause and send love to his family and to all the people who love him and support him, because that was really, really shocking today. And I will leave it there.
Finally, Lord have mercy.
Oh, wait, Jesus. I got a few more. I want to say, I'm kidding.
I just had a quick honorable mention to a one Gabrielle Union and Tracee Ellis Ross, who both celebrated their birthdays. They look amazing for their ages.
They look amazing, period.
I mean, yes, but, you know, I'm also talking specifically, you know, everybody's like, Gabrielle Union's 50 years old? Yeah, honey, she 50 years old. Okay, that good Black don't crack. Okay, now the bad Black. The bad Black do crack. Oh, I know no. We say that Black don't crack, but come on now. I'm not going to say no names because I'm a God-fearing Christian woman. Just like good white and bad white.
No,
it's good Latinx and bad Latinx. You know, it's universal.
Not touching that.
Everybody don't get grandfathered into, you know, youthful looking skin, whatever that's supposed to mean. Anyway, that's it. That's all I got. Now it's time for Black History is happening every day.
All right, so for Black History is happening every day. Number one, I'm always astounded by how long you hold that, because we always insert it as a clip and we don't hear it. But then when I listen back to the show, I'm always like, Jesus Christ, you hold that for a really long time.
It's called breath control. Try it.
I think this episode might also potentially be called Travel's Breath Control. Is that what you would prefer?
No, because it has nothing to do with the topic at hand, but okay.
I'm saying we had this conversation with Chris Rivas. Like, it's a thing. Anyway, I'm very excited about this new school that's happening. It's called the Becoming Collegiate Academy, home of the Brown Bears over there in HBCU, a Focus Elementary School. And I saw this story and I just thought it was exciting because they are in Jacksonville, Florida. And they, according to the post that I see here, they're designed to embody the HBCU culture. The college prep school is tuition-free with an HBCU-style education from academics to the learning environment. environment. The ABCs start with A for Alcorn State University and end with Z for Zora Neale Hurston. This is coming from at Black Dollar Network on Instagram. And so the reason that this actually stood out to me is, one, it's very dope. Like, I would be intrigued by the idea of sending my kid to a school this way. Mind you, I don't know that I want to live in Jacksonville, Florida to do that. Shout out to the people in Florida. But what the reason that I liked this was, this is how we are going to start seeing the resistance happen in all of these different places that are having, you know, critical race theory, you know, legislation, the ways that we see, you know, trans folks being written out of education, all of the different ways that we see, like, things changing. We're also going to start seeing this interesting resistance, right? The ways that we can educate our kids differently, the way that we can include people in different kinds of ways. And so I saw this and was really, really inspired by it. You can follow them on Instagram at Becoming Collegiate. You can find out more information on them at all of the different places on the internet machine.
Love the idea behind this school overall. I will just note, in response to what you just mentioned about, you know, the ways that the resistance will show up, is that, you know, we should not have to create a, you know, elementary school styled after an HBCU to be able to teach about, you know, Black shit, you know? You know, it's just that interesting kind of slither on the other side of this. But I'm sure I hear stories all the time about Black folks who, like, went to schools and programs when they were younger that were, like, put on by the Nation of Islam or put on by this, you know, Black focused group or entity in their various local communities, and how it, you know, transformed, you know, their educational experience, like, going forward and stuff like that. And so I love the general idea behind this. So shout out to those students and the folks over there in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, I want to say they also, like, prepare kids for college. And, like, I also, while I think that's really cool, I also want to indicate, like, college is not for everybody, right? Everybody should not be going to college. I do think we overemphasize academia at the cost of various other forms of learning, but I do think this is really, really dope.
Well, I'm sure W in the alphabet stands for W.E.B. Du Bois and the Talented Ten.
For Webb Du Bois.
So here we are.
Not
Webb. You ain't right.
We thank y'all so much for checking out Fans High. We ask that if you're listening on a platform that allows you to rate and subscribe, we ask that you do that. Hit us up on Apple Podcasts using leaving a 5-star rating and leaving us a review, letting us know what you think about the show. If you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, we're at Fans High Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Use the hashtag FansHighFam or send us an email to fanshigh@maximumfun.org.
And if you'd like to become a financially contributing member of the Fanti fam, you can do that at MaximumFun.org/join. Okay, our music is brought to you, as always, by the one and only Coreece. That's Core.ECE, wherever you get Slayworthy audio. Our graphics are by Ashley Nguyen, and our editor is Nihar Patel.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Is a production of Breath Control or Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
I don't think I've had pumpkin with cream cheese because it sounds like it's giving, like, carrot cake flavors, which...
It's a protein shake.
Protein shake with cream cheese. I don't know what that means, but it sounds like something I would fuck with.